You're listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast with Pastor Adam Powers. At Sunrise, we desire that the glory of God would be the glory of this city. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. Let's join Pastor Adam for this week's message.
Well, it is good now to be back in our main diet. As a congregation, we took, remember, last Christmas, we took all of December going through Ruth for our Advent series. We then took all of January for our church series called Unprogrammed. And now we're back in our main diet, our verse-by-verse exploration through the book of Genesis. Remember, we started this last August, and we've made some headway. We only got to chapter 9, but that's okay. Lord willing, the plan is to get to chapter 36 by May. That might be too adventurous for us, or for me. Andrew could be done with the book, maybe. So we'll see. But we've covered a lot of ground in our time together so far. We've seen the beauty of the beginning in Genesis 1, where there was once nothing. By the end of Genesis 2, there is now everything. All creation has been made, all creatures have been made, and there reigning over it all is Adam and Eve, the kings, the rulers of creation, to be ruling underneath the King of Kings, God Himself. We then saw the horror of Genesis 3 come as our first parents sinned through their disobedience, corrupting all things, spreading death to all things. And for this, our first parents, who had often enjoyed sweet communion and such close fellowship with God, walking in the garden in the cool of the day as often as they desired, now were banished from the garden. And we would be hopeless if it weren't for that promise in Genesis 3:15 that God made, that there's a coming one who will crush the snake, the serpent of old, the devil. And while he'll defeat him, he'll redeem his people. We'd be hopeless if that verse did not exist. But it does, and so we remain hopeless. Though Adam and Eve now go off east of Eden, and as they do, things turn from bad to worse. Mankind grows, spreads, populates, births, cultures, civilization, and the arts are made. But with all these good things that are being made, brutality, arrogance, and wickedness run wild. So much so, by the time we get to Genesis chapter 6, God is grieving that He made man in the first place and decides to wipe everybody out, everybody except Noah and his family. That's where we meet this man. He's introduced to us as Noah, the righteous man, the blameless man, the one who found favor with God. And so the same waters that drowned all humanity are the waters that saved Noah and his family as the ark floats up and up and up. A new covenant was made, a new world was started, new worship happened as they left the ark and began anew in God's new world. Surely, things would go good this time. Surely, Noah would remain righteous and blameless and still in the favor of God, and God's new world would be pure now, no more sin, right? Well, wrong. We enter into our text today, Genesis chapter 9, verse 18 to 29, where we're going to learn the difference, give you some technical terms, between naked and naked. A wise older gentleman, very influential to me, my father-in-law, once told me this. He said, "Do you know the difference between naked and naked?" And I said, "No, I don't. What is the difference?" He said, "Naked's what Adam and Eve were in the garden. If you're naked, nothing good's happening. Such is our text today in Genesis chapter 9. Jump in with me as I read the first two verses. Verse 18 and 19 say the following. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah. And from these, the people of the whole earth were dispersed. This short and simple introduction to our passage today shifts the central character away from Noah, the central figure of the former chapters, to the descendants of Noah that will be in view the rest of the book of Genesis. And so, chapter 9 here, this is a big end to this section. We called them toledotes when we first started. There's 10 toledotes through Genesis. This is now the end of one. We'll begin another in chapter 10. Notice two quick things in these first two verses that stand out that are worth mentioning. In verse 18, notice the mention of Ham's son. What's his name? What's it say? Canaan. Who, question, was the original audience of the book of Genesis? Who were the first readers of it? Do we remember this? Israel. We said the context was after the wilderness wanderings, before they went into the promised land, which just so happened to be named Canaan, that this son is mentioned in verse 18 and 19 here of Ham, his name is Canaan, would have been monumental in importance to the original audience, Israel, as they're headed to the land named after this son, Canaan. So this shows them something of the origin of this land and the origin of the people that came to dwell in this land. Second, notice in verse 19, it speaks of all the peoples of the earth being dispersed from the three sons of Noah, right? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This means, if you remember, that Genesis 9, verse 1 actually happened. If you remember Genesis 9, 1, you can just look back, it's right there. Noah and his sons received the same command and blessing from God. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." It's the same command Adam received and Eve in Genesis 1, 28. So Noah is a new kind of Adam in a new world, and that verse 19 exists in chapter 9, saying that the whole earth was populated through these guys. They did verse 1. They were fruitful, they did multiply, and they have now filled the earth. This seems like a small item, perhaps, to call attention to, but when it's just been your family on a boat for as long as this family has been, this is a big deal. It's now no longer just them. There are more people on the earth. As we'll see, Lord willing, next week as we get through Genesis chapter 10, what's famously called the Table of Nations. So, our text has been introduced. Let's get into the mess of what happens here. Our first point today, if you've got a bookmark on your way in, it's on the bottom of it, on the back, Noah's sin. Look with me at verse 20 and 21. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. That was quick. That was quick, right? Such a quick description of the downfall of the man we only know to be, from this point, righteous and blameless. Now drunk and naked? Well, it's not surprising, after being the man of the ark, building it for so long, and then being the man of the sea with just his family for so long, that once he gets off the boat, it's as if Noah comes on the ground and is like, I'm a man of the ground now. I am done with the water. I'm done with the sea. But he becomes such a man of the ground that he plants a vineyard, produces his own wine, and drinks so much of it that he ends up drunk and passed out in his tent. Which raises the question, what in the world happened to Noah? Right? I mean, why? Why did he do this? There are some options here. First thing perhaps we think of is this the same Noah that we read of before? There are actually big, thick books on Genesis you can read that are helpful in some points that will say at this point, this is not the same Noah. Clearly, that guy was righteous, blameless in his generation, finding favor with God. That's not this guy. He's drunk and naked in his house. And so they say, clearly this is a contradiction in the Bible for us to see. And to that, we just say, no, that's not what's going on. That's not only dishonest, it's just flat out wrong. Just because Noah was at one time in his life righteous and blameless does not guarantee that he'll continue to be righteous and blameless for the rest of his life. I mean, we all know people that at one time in their life fought against the deepest battles of sin, that then at another point in life just gave full freedom to them and lived in those sins that they once hated and avoided. So we're faced with this question, why? Why did Noah do this? Is this evidence of a kind of like PTSD after the flood? Like it was so traumatic for him watching God kill all humanity in his wrath and judgment as the waters are rising and people are maybe trying to grip the side of the ark to hang on to this thing in the midst of it, that he just somehow snapped from the trauma of it and just can't handle it, and so he just got to find some way to escape? Or maybe Noah on the ark had too much family time. And we can barely do, it seems at times, like a one-week holiday at Thanksgiving or Christmas or the summer, and Noah's on the ark for a year with just family. He gets off and he's like, I gotta grow something to drink. That's thinking poorly of Noah. Maybe it's more innocent options. Maybe Noah just didn't know that that's what wine does to you. Probably not the case. Maybe he was inexperienced with that much wine or those kind of grapes and the reaction and the result of drinking so much of them. Maybe, though we never hear of her in this passage, I'm dang curious to know what she's doing. Maybe this is evidence of what was almost a romantic evening between Noah and Mrs. Noah. But too much wine happened and this is the result. All in all, speculation could run amok here, and we don't know why Noah is in the state that he's in. To me, the best explanation is simply that Noah sins here, and he sins greatly. Verse 20 to 21 come at us very quick. It's a very quick description. But think about it. Is planting a vineyard, growing your own grapes, cultivating them, taking those said grapes into wine that's actually drinkable, is that a quick process? Not at all. Noah had to plan this. He is not just a man of the ground any longer. He is a seasoned cultivator, a professional vineyard planter at this point. He knows exactly what he's doing. I think it's perhaps more likely that after the ark, Noah began to do this and enjoy the fruits of the soil. He began drinking, and slowly that just increased to the point where now, clearly, it's out of control, and he has disgraced himself, shamed himself, drinking to the point of uncovering himself, and by doing so, he has technically, right, covered himself with shame. So, this is a new world. This is a post-flood world. But the same sin that called forth before the flood the great waters of wrath and judgment, that same sin is now seen to be present in Noah. Yikes. But Noah's not the only one that has sinned in this episode. Let's continue on and see next Ham's sin in verse 22 and 23. And Ham, the father of Canaan, notice the second mention of this son, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, in case you didn't get it the first time, he's going to repeat himself, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Here's some more things we don't know about this situation. Why was Ham in the tent at all? Was it just the wrong place at the wrong time? I mean, that could be the case. It does not appear to be the case, though. We'll examine this. If you look down to verse 25, a few more verses past this point, you'll notice it says, when Noah came to, when he literally awoke from his wine, he had a lot of wine. So this is clearly an indication this sleep was from the alcoholic stupor that he was in. He learned, or he knew, what his son had done to him. That's what I thought when I was like, what did Ham do? Because verse 22 and 23, where it describes it, it just mentions he saw his father's nakedness and told his brothers. But verse 25 mentions something that Ham actually did to Noah, which begs the question, what did Ham do? Well, at this point, you should know there have been wild and numerous opinions down through the history of the church of people, theologians we love, near and dear to our hearts. We have quotes of them on their wall, from early church back to Augustine to Luther and the Reformation and Calvin and all of the above. Here's some options that's been put forth through the history of the church. Some believe that Ham committed sodomy with Noah, that there was a homosexual deed done to his father. Others believe that Ham castrated Noah. You can hear a pin drop right now. Still, others believe that when it says right there that phrase, father's nakedness, at the end of verse 23, the way that phrase is used, and it's true in other parts of these first five books, the Torah in the Bible, that refers to a man's wife, your father's nakedness. So another option people have put forward back here is that there was some kind of sexually deviant action done by Ham to his mother, Noah's wife. And the fourth option, we're not done yet, believe it or not, others put forth the option that Ham physically abused Noah in some way or other. The imagination runs wild with these things. Before you rule out these options, because we're going to, I don't think any of these happened. Remember what book we're in. This is the book of Genesis. You're like, duh, I know that. But Genesis 9, specifically, through about 38, we're going to see time and time again where family member to another family member does some of the most immoral, wicked things possible that people can do to another human. These are not out of the question based on the rest of what happens in Genesis. Now, why do I think these didn't happen? Well, in all those cases, all of them, where vile deeds immorally are done, they're all, we probably wouldn't desire this, but they're all described for us. We're going to get to some moments in Genesis where it kind of needs like a parental warning. Because it gets pretty graphic here, and it describes these things. That doesn't happen in our text. So I don't think that that's what's going on. I think we actually find the answer in our text as we look at the comparison between verse 22 and Ham's actions and verse 23, the actions of Shem and Japheth, the other brothers. Compared to verse 22, I mean the fast, speedy nature of it, did you notice how that's not present in verse 23? Verse 23 is slow, methodical, repetitive. It doesn't want you to miss a moment of what these brothers did to cover Noah. It's like a play-by-play account of what happened. They took a garment, they laid it on their shoulders. They walked backwards, and without seeing Noah's nakedness, repetition, because their faces were turned backwards, they covered him up. The author doesn't want us to miss all the steps and the intentionality that came into Shem and Japheth's work in covering up the embarrassing moment for Dad. This might be difficult for modern Westerners to understand and get really what's going on here. I think that's the reason why a lot of people go crazy with what Ham did, what they think he did, because we don't understand what would ultimately become the fifth commandment, honoring father and mother. In this culture, it was supreme in virtue to honor father and mother. You lived to do this in this culture, and that's exactly what Shem and Japheth did. They planned it step by step, intentionally put this garment on the back of their shoulders, backed up. They're still holding it. They're waiting to see toes. And so they don't see it. They just kind of throw the cloak behind them and cover up the embarrassing moment that Dad had, covering his sin. It's sin, and they cover it up. This is exactly what Ham didn't do. What did Ham do? He did what verse 22 says. He went in, maybe he overheard Noah getting rowdy and drunk, and I mean, he's probably like in his early 100s right now. He's not a 7-year-old, but this is very immature kind of 7-year-old action, isn't it? Like he walks in, he sees naked Noah, drunk and passed out. Maybe he even sees the garment there, takes it, goes out and to Shem and Japheth, says, "Hey, Dad's drunk and passed out." And they rightly take the garment, bring it back in, and cover their father's disgrace. By doing this, by going to tell his brothers about Noah's nakedness, Ham further uncovered his father's misdeeds to his brothers. And his brothers commendably covered it up. I think that's what happened here. So again, this is a new world, yet the same sin that called forth the wrath and judgment of God in the flood that was present still in Noah that we just saw, we now see to be very present in Ham as well. So let's see how Noah responds to this when he comes to. See Noah's response in verse 24 to 27. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew, notice right here it says his youngest son. Little side point that I don't know, maybe some of you can find this out. Every time these three brothers are mentioned, Ham's always in the middle. It's Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But here we learn that Ham's the younger son, the youngest son. So it's Shem, Japheth, and Ham. I don't know why he's always in the middle. If anyone finds out, keep me posted. Continuing. And he knew what his youngest son had done to him. He said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. Well, when Noah woke up from his wine, notice he knew, he learned, because his brothers probably told him, what Ham had done to him. And when Noah says, cursed be Canaan, we ought to say, time out. These are not only the very first words recorded of Noah in the Bible, which is monumental. His very first words are, cursed be Canaan. We've seen him righteous, blameless. We've seen him build the ark. We've seen him ride out the flood. Now, for the first time, he actually has talking words in the Bible, and it's a curse on Canaan. This is also the very first time in these early chapters in the Bible that a curse comes from the lips of man. Before this, it's always God who brings the curse, brings the blessing. And now, it's Noah doing this. So this is a monumental shift we're seeing here. But in his first words, curse be Canaan. I wonder if you're asking it, right? Why Canaan? I mean, are you wondering this? Canaan wasn't the one that did the deed. Ham was the one that did the deed. Canaan is Ham's youngest son. What in the world's going on here? Is this a typo? Oops. Some people believe that's a typo. And they say that a monk in like the 7th century in their cave, while he's copying down the scriptures, I mean, what a labor of love that we still have copies and copies and oodles and copies of the Bible, that maybe the candle went out, maybe there was a gust of wind that blew it out, and maybe he just sneezed and whoop, forgot where he was and just wrote Canaan instead of Ham, that's why this is the way it is. Clearly this is an error. Wrong. I don't think that's what happened. Those writers were extremely careful, and there were tons of them. If all of them made the same mistake, we might want to say, okay, what's going on here? But if one of them were to, and the rest of them had the right one, they would have ruled this one out. So I don't think this is what's in view here. Some, you should know, some of your study Bibles even say this. They say, we don't know why Noah curses Canaan instead of Ham. And they just move on to verse 27. I don't like that answer, personally. It's not helpful, though there are things we don't know. There are also scholars and theologians and your study Bibles that actually give options. They say, we're not quite sure what's going on here. They all start like this, but here's some options of why Noah could have legitimately cursed Canaan instead of Ham. Here's the first one. It's commonly given. Genesis 9:1. God blesses Noah and his sons. And so because God is blessing Ham to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, Noah cannot curse Ham. And so he tries to, I think somewhat, it seems like vindictively, get back at Ham by cursing his youngest son. People believe this. That's not a good option. I don't think that's a good option. Here's another option. Second, because it was Ham, Noah's youngest son, that sinned against him, in an ironic twist, which also seems vindictive, Noah says, well, if you're going to trouble me so much, my youngest son, your youngest son's going to trouble you. Cursed be Canaan. That also kind of paints Noah in a dubious light. But I mean, he's drunk and naked, so that's probably not out of bounds. I don't like any of these options, but there's one more. The third one that I do like, I can understand it a little bit better, but I'm not the litmus test for these things. Have fun in small group this week. Here's the third option. The sons of Noah embody the character of their descendants. The sons of Noah embody the character of their descendants. Ham's sons were Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Four sons from which peoples would come bearing those names that would be some of the most vile and wicked people in history that actually do and are characterized by the vile actions many people think Ham did here in the tent to Noah. So what does this all mean? Noah's curse on Canaan in verse 26 represents God's judgment on the Canaanites, which again would have greatly helped Israel as they're reading this on the way to Canaan to wipe out the Canaanites. This gives reason why God is judging them. Before the fact, he explains how they got to be how they got to be. This seems best to me because it explains these things. And also, notice three times, to Canaan, to Shem, and to Japheth, in all these curses and blessings, three times it says here, Canaan will be subject to God's people. This is because they'll be wiped out by them. Some of them will be enslaved by them. Well, that's the curse. Let's go to the blessing. We find it next. The first one is about Shem. The next one is Japheth. For Shem, the blessing Noah gives is not so much about Shem, is it? But the God of Shem. That this God ought to be praised and loved and blessed. Why? For being Shem's God. Praising God for being God. The people of Israel would come from the descendants of Shem, and the Israelites would indeed be used by God to bring God great glory and fame and blessing and honor. We get a little bitty preview of what's going to happen with God's people right here in this blessing to Shem. And the blessing to Japheth next is as beautiful. It's a little bit peculiar at first. The name Japheth means something like enlarging. And so there's a play on words here. May God enlarge you. May he do what your name means, that you have tons of descendants. And may you dwell, Japheth, in the tents of Shem. That's the confusing part, because in the Old Testament, this really didn't happen. Japheth's descendants, well, Shem, think descendants become the Israelites. Japheth's descendants become the nations. What's another word for the nations? Gentiles. This is clear in the New Covenant how this is answered, isn't it? How do Gentiles come into the tent, the promises of the God of Israel? Through Christ the Messiah. In verse 27, we get a preview, though very hidden and in seed form, of what the gospel would one day bring about when all the nations stream into the God of Israel through Christ the Messiah. Beautiful. Then the passage ends with Noah's eulogy. And it's very quick and very brief, not many words. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950, and he died. So I know I ask this question a lot. I think it's a good question. What do we do with this? I could just let you go right now, have fun in small group talking about naked drunkenness and what not to do when this happens to our parents or to one another or to ourselves. But that would not be pastorally faithful. So let's pull out some threads here and figure out what to make of this. Let's take the big sinners of the text and learn from them, because this is us. We are also big sinners. We need to learn from them. First, let's look at Noah. This is certainly not the main thrust of the passage, and it's not the main point, so we will not belabor it. But there needs to be something said, and we need to hear the vain nature of alcohol. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that drinking alcohol is sin. Drunkenness is condemned in a lot of places. But you know what word also appears almost every time the word drunkenness appears in the Bible? Nakedness. Because these two are put together, it means they often go together. One thing leads to the other. It's almost like an on-ramp, and this is the highway. You can't just get on the on-ramp and stop. That's not what an on-ramp is for. They're paired together, and that they're paired together, we should be vigilant in guarding ourselves against these things. Now again, drinking alcohol is not sin. The Bible never says this. Drunkenness is. The Psalms actually say wine gladdens the heart of man. And everybody goes to this place when they talk about these things, but Jesus made the best wine in John chapter 2 at the wedding of Cana. But drunkenness is sin. And so, we have a great need to be wise. I mean, is it okay pastorally for me to tell you, you probably should not drink very much, because if you do, you're going to end up naked. There's your. You didn't think you'd hear that coming to church today, did you? Let's not have that be the video you send out this week, Andrew. But let's press into this maybe a little bit more. Don't miss when this happens to Noah, okay? Noah, his fall from grace, I think this is rightly, we could call it this. This happened after the flood, after he built the ark, after he survived the flood, after the fight to build what God had commanded for 100 years or so with just his sons, building a big boat when it's likely they've not seen much water before. Why would we need a boat? He fights the fight of faith to build the boat. He fights the fight of faith when he sees it start to rain. It says, come, get on board. It's time. It's time. Then the Lord shuts them in and they hang on for dear life for a year as they're just floating about in this ark going wherever the ocean will take them. And then he comes out successful after this fight. They haven't killed each other on the boat, and he worships the Lord and makes sacrifices to him. After the victory is won, it's as if Noah relaxes, gets very restful and easy, and ends up drunk and naked. One author put it like this. Mark it very well, Christian. Satan may go hardest after you in a moment of rest, in the time of triumph, in the season after the storm, when you believe you did it, you made it, you arrived, you passed the test, and then you're drunk, naked, and pass out in your tent. I hope you believe what I'm about to tell you. Some of you don't, and you need to. Life will teach you this is true. Anyone put in the right situation is capable of anything. Noah, prime example. Do not think, I'd never do that. In the right circumstances, you would. Anyone would. We need to learn from this and be vigilant in our living, in our enjoying the liberties that God has given us, the good gifts he's given us, not to abuse them, but to use them rightly. Let's look at Ham now. What can we learn from Ham, the other big sinner in the text? His dishonoring of his father also teaches us much. It seems that Ham took perverse pleasure in sharing his father's folly with his brothers. In this, Ham sinned by doing two things. He dishonored his father, and he sinned more by spreading the word of his father's shame to his brothers. Many today, I think, like, right, let's give each other the benefit of the doubt. We're keen to honor our parents. I think that's good of us. We should do this. But we're only keen and eager to do this insofar as our parents don't sin against us. If they don't harm us, if they don't cultivate unhealthy relationships with us and unhealthy expectations of us, I mean, you can go to counselor after counselor after counselor after counselor, and they will tell you, your parents are toxic, you need to cut them out of your lives. And we're like, okay. And you just never talk to them again. That would have been unthinkable in Noah's time, and that would have been immediately a dishonoring of parents. There has to be nuance here, right? I don't want to say that every situation is like this or that there's not real harm done by real parents to real children that needs really to be worked through with help from professionals, etc. But I'm just wondering, if we're in that place, what would we do? Would we be Ham or would we be Shem or Japheth? Ham, it seemed, couldn't care less about Noah, while Shem and Japheth took steps to make up for their father's embarrassing mess. Would you do this for others? Would you do this for your parents? Would you cover their sins in this way? Or in the spirit of our modern day cancel culture, would you say, nope, you sinned, you have to get what you deserve, and I'm going to share about it on Twitter until the world knows everything that you've done? That's not really a Christian bent, is it? It's not a gospel posture to have that. And we also learn from Ham, if that's not challenging enough, we learn that it's sin to delight in spreading the sins of others. And I think where this happens inside the church most is in prayer meetings and in after church talk, before church talk, in between service talk. Someone comes up to you and says, I'm really concerned about so-and-so. Oh, why? Well, they did blankety blank blank blank. You never get to praying for them. All you've done is just shared their dirty laundry. Or maybe you're in a prayer meeting and you're like, oh, I have a prayer request. So-and-so did blankety blank blank. Okay. TMI? Maybe? This is how it often looks. Under the mask of well-intentioned Christian love, we share one another's dirty laundry. And in a sense, uncover them before many others that they don't want to be uncovered to. Where we ought to be like Shem and Japheth, covering the sins of others. We need to cover one another. So Ham displays what not to do. Shem and Japheth show us what to do. And what else does this mean but putting actually into practice what 1 Peter 4:8 says when it says love covers a multitude of sins? This is what we're called to do with one another. I'm not saying you justify the sins of anyone. You deal with them, but you deal with them with that person in trying to cover sin and disgrace and mitigate or lessen the embarrassment that this person will face because of these things. This is what love looks like from Christian to Christian. And the world ought to see something different in us because Jesus said they'll see how you love one another and they'll know that you know me. So we ought to be a people characterized by covering one another instead of airing everyone's dirty laundry. Lastly, I think in a bigger picture, we see massive parallels between Adam, the first Adam, and Noah here. Adam was made from the ground, the Adama, right? That's where he gets his name, literally man of the dust, man of the ground. Adama. When it says in verse 20 that Noah became a man of the soil, it's not surprising then to read in the Hebrew, Noah became a man of the Adama. He was Adamish in his behavior, in his calling. Adam, part of his duties as priest in the garden was to tend the garden. There was tilling work and cultivating work that needed to be done. Noah, a new kind of Adam, cultivated and planted a vineyard. Another similarity. Adam was once naked and ashamed. Noah was once naked and both shamed and ashamed. Both Adam and Noah have descendants that have to deal with the mess of their own sin. And both Adam and Noah, these passages around them, include words of blessing and cursing. But most importantly, don't miss it. Both Adam and Noah, God be praised, had their sins covered. The animal skins were, the animals were sacrificed. God made the skins, covered the shame of our first parents. Noah is covered by his other two sons, Shem and Japheth. Lesson? Yes, the Genesis 9 world's a new world. There's new covenants. There's a new kind of Adam in view, a new beginning. But the same sin that once brought forth God's judgment in the flood is not only present in Noah, not only present in Ham, it's still present in you and in me. But praise God that when the time was right, another Adam came forth. Paul calls him the second Adam in Romans 5, 1 Corinthians 15, the last Adam, the last one. Everything we lost in Adam, this one will bring us back and more. This is the Lord Jesus, who by his death on the cross covers once and for all the sin and shame of all who believe in him. So the massive question for us in driving this home is, where do we see the gospel here? Why is this a Christian passage? It's because Jesus is the ultimate one who covers. And you need to know this. Many of you are struggling. Some of you are doing great, and that's wonderful. But some of you are really not doing great, and you need to remember that all the sin that you feel right now, exposed and naked and ashamed, if you're banking on Jesus, it's all covered. And one another probably needs to stop uncovering it and reminding us of how covered it is, never to be seen again. Jesus is the ultimate covering where we can hide in him forever. That's the gospel point of the naked drunken man in Genesis 9.
Thank you for listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. We pray you are blessed by the preaching of God's Word. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. May the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all.